Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. Other than hosting this show, I'm also the beverage director at a couple of restaurants in downtown New York City, Dell'Anima, L'Artusi, La Picho, and our little wine bar, Anfora. And before we get started today, this is one of the last few days you'll be hearing our little reminder message about joining as a member for Heritage Radio Network. All you have to do is go to the website heritageradionetwork.org, hit that donate button, and you'll get all sorts of nifty little things like a membership card. You'll hear about all the events, special discounts. I was a member before I was a host, and I was happy that I made that decision. I am just like ecstatic today. We have on a group of people who are opening up one of the most anticipated openings. There's a lot of people I know who are super, super excited about this team, about the restaurant Ivan Ramen opening up on the Lower East Side later this year. From Ivan Ramen, we have Ivan Orkin, the chef. Bill Reed is going to be running the front of house. Bill is his second time on the show. We've had him last year for his role at Brooklyn Star. He's partner and beverage director and does all sorts of great stuff there. And I love Brooklyn Star, by the way. And Mike Bergman is the chef who's going to be running the kitchen down at Ivan Ramen. So thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
All right. So this is going to be, for those of you who aren't familiar, Ivan has two restaurants in Tokyo, Ivan Ramen and Ivan Ramen Plus. And this is your first foray into New York. What brought this team together? Why New York? How did this all come together?
Yeah, it was sort of time to come back to New York and get back into the whole family thing and get back to my roots and play in the New York playground.
All right, so you originally grew up here in New York. Where exactly?
In Long Island.
In Long Island.
On the North Shore, in Syosset. Grew up in Oyster Bay Cove, went to school in Syosset, and, born and raised New York guy, and Brooklyn for many, many, before Brooklyn was cool. I left right when Brooklyn got officially cool.
Well, I can relate. I mean, I grew up in Queens and then moved out to Long Island, and I think Queens, for many people, still is not cool. I don't think I'll ever reach that kind of Brooklyn cool status, but definitely people who are looking for interesting food experiences think Queens is all right. And so grew up here in New York, made this remarkably brave move to pick everything up and go to Tokyo after...
Well, you know, the only thing brave about it was that I was 40 when I did it. it was my second time to go and live in Japan. The first time I was, I just graduated with a degree in Japanese language and culture and literature and everything. And, of course, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I don't think too many college graduates do. And it sort of made sense to go and go live in Japan and see what it was like to speak Japanese.
Would you say it was during that time where you made the decision that I'm going to go to culinary school and
No, I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I was sort of teaching English, which I actually really like teaching, and I think part of being a chef is teaching. And I think I'm pretty good at teaching, and I've really enjoyed that aspect of this job. Training staff and working with people and sort of communicating my vision of what I want in my kitchen or in the front of the house, or whatever. But I think teaching English, you know, for me was not all that exciting, and I didn't really like it that much, and I realized I was sort of spinning my wheels in Tokyo. And so with great sadness, I left in early 1990 to go back to the States. And I worked a really lousy job that I hated, selling computer components. I still don't know what they do. And I had this epiphany that I wanted to cook. I went to the CIA back in, that was in 92.
I mean, you guys are all involved in this project, I mean, imagine, because you truly love food, truly love ramen. I think it'd be interesting to hear if any of you had any other also like really shitty kind of jobs before getting into the food industry. And that's one of the exciting things about what we do. We can be excited about it. We can, you know, talk about it in our free time when we're not at work with our friends, because it's fun and interesting and exciting. I'll start. I worked at Old Navy, and I had one of those headsets. That's why I'm so comfortable with this headset, actually.
I was actually a background dancer for many years.
No.
Throughout high school into early college years.
Party enhancer.
And did a lot of party enhancing. Actually, I worked for a company called All Around Entertainment that did the metro area, and I danced it over about 100 bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and weddings.
Nice. That's incredible.
And it was sometimes really great and sometimes really not.
He sold branded thongs.
Mesh shirts.
No, definitely mesh shirts. It was really weird because the kids would pick out outfits for the dancers to wear sometimes. And sometimes they were really inappropriate for my body.
I bet you knew the whole album of La Bouche.
Culinary was the last thing on my mind until I guess about the third year I moved to New York City, because I was still doing that, and I was working in some design, some art design for Mark Echo's clothing line, and out of necessity to make fast cash, I started to waitering and busing and bartending, and then started to realize that I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's something liberating about figuring that out. You're like, wait a second, I can actually do something I really like and make a living at it.
Well, still entertainment. Yeah. I still find that running the front of house in any restaurant is very much like a play, mm-hmm. or like a dance recital, where you're taking care of people and you're educating people. And then, you know, the good thing about it is 40 minutes, 50 minutes, they're gone, and you get to take care of new people. Yeah. And it's really exciting that way.
That's the new restaurant, Billy Dances.
Right.
Yeah. All right, you, Mike.
I never had anything too embarrassing. And as a kid in the summers, I was like essentially a janitor for a few summers. That's about it. I thought it was pretty cool, though. I think that, at least for me, it was cool to see all the behind-the-scenes stuff going on in the school when you're in, like, eighth grade. You go through teachers' desks, things like that.
Nice.
And your first first restaurant job?
Dishwashing in Portland, Oregon. I've started dishwashing, then worked in a hotel, and then the first job I really liked in a restaurant was at this bakery called Ken's in Portland, Oregon.
Nice. Gabe from Gabe, my business partner, the executive chef, also got his first really great restaurant job in Portland. But so going back to you, Ivan, you finished culinary school and then got a job in some of these great restaurants in New York. Lutece, Mesa Grill, back in the day.
Well, back in the day, I mean, this is 25 years ago, and it's very different now. You know, the world, back then, the great, you know, in cooking school, most of the teachers were Austrian or German or French, Swedish. There weren't many American chefs, and, what's his name? Forgione and some of these guys who were coming up. Those were the guys that were sort of leading the trail. But it was still very early, and you know, American cuisine didn't exist practically. But most of me and my friends, we were sort of on that whole fine dining trail. I did my externship at Mesa Grill. Actually, went to try to get a job at Bobby's then wife at Montrachet. And Deborah Ponczak, and she didn't have any. She had just filled the last position she had free, but she said, you know, my husband Bobby might have something. So she called him, and I went over there, and that was a great job. I learned a lot there.
And do you think that it's important for young chefs, even if they want to do a more casual kind of food or something very specific like ramen, to have a basis and a background in classical French or some sort of finer dining restaurant?
No, I don't know that I would say that. I would say that cooking is a really serious thing, and it's like music or anything that requires a base level of knowledge. You know, I mean, I mean, there are some people that are, you know, good at anything off the bat, and those are those people. But most of us, me included, you know, you have to do things like cooking over and over again before you can actually start to understand flavor profiles and understand how to coax flavor out of things before you can start, you know, doing things well. I just think, and I come from the old school. I like I said, back then, you didn't work, you know, 3 months and put it on your resume and say I worked there, and you worked and you didn't tell the chef that you had a great idea because you'd get smacked in the head and probably sent home with your knives in the street.
Yeah, well, I'm personally really curious about your time at Lutèce. Every year I help out at this event for the University Settlement, which is just a great foundation. They provide low-cost housing for people and just life services as well. And to thank me, they gave me this gift that was, I think, not equal to the amount of service that I provided. But they gave me a wine list from Lutèce from 1962.
Wow. Well, that's kind of cool, though.
Incredibly cool. I feel almost guilty having it to myself, and I want to perhaps find some place where I could donate it, like maybe
Aster
New York
collection.
Library. The Aster Collection. Yeah. It's a great cookbook collection. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's menus. Oh. It's at the main branch. It's really cool.
At the New York Library in Bryant Park? Aster Collection, you're going to be hearing from me. I think they have one of our early Dell'Anima menus. But what was it like? That was one of the last really great old guard.
Well, and I think that part of the way I see things is when you work, I mean, how do you describe it? I mean, by that time, it was already sort of on its. It was just a legendary place, and there were a lot of new places starting to come up. But he was a larger than life. He is. I don't want to put him out the pasture. He's still a very active chef. But you know, he came down every single morning at 9 a.m. like clockwork and checked which customers were coming in, which regulars, and what had to be made, and he would call the fish company and do whatever he did. But it was, for me, it was very impactful to see the way he worked, and very impressive the way he would sort of walk around the dining room and greet customers, which his sense of hospitality was really impressive.
Cool. I have a question here from one of our listeners, actually from a friend of mine, Scott Sosman, who's the general manager of Colicchio & Sons, which is a great restaurant.
Yeah, I've been there.
Gabe and his wife Catherine go every year for Thanksgiving. It's an awesome place. He wants to know, for people who don't subscribe to PR machines, how do you feel about all the hype that you guys have been getting?
Well, I don't have a PR machine. I mean, I've always had a rule. I've had very successful media experience in Japan, and I didn't have anybody helping me there either. But I tend to respond to anybody who writes with something reasonable, you know, interviews and things like that. I respond to them all. And in Japan, you know, I did interviews with people who had little tiny journals, and I was in the Tokyo, the Toyota Auto Company's monthly magazine, which I thought was so interesting because 30,000 employees read it every month. And so I would have such an interesting array of people because in Japan, so the ramen thing is mostly, you know, the ramen media is limited to people who want to eat ramen. But for me, I was able to sort of reach out to a lot of different people who normally would never eat ramen. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of really interesting customers come to my restaurant. And I mean, I'm a business person. To me, you know, all that media, what does it really mean? I want people to come to my establishment and try my food and you know, become a customer.
And did you find in Japan that people pay attention to ramen the way that we do here in New York? We're kind of overanalyzing pizza or hamburgers, people get excited and argue about it. And
I had one guy write on his blog that he should have seen. He said, well, I think that the katsuobushi was about 7% in the soup, and the noodles I would estimate were 55 to 60 centimeters long. And I mean, it was like the most anal thing. And you'd watch these guys eating the food, and they'd be sniffing their ladle with the you know, and pretty intense judging of the different qualities of the stuff I was making.
So you and Mike just got back from Japan, and Mike, tell me about some of your experiences while you guys were there. What were you doing? Were you doing more research for the upcoming restaurant? Was this a kind of a pleasure trip to relax a little bit before the insanity of opening up a place?
It was definitely for business and pleasure. I think for Ivan, it was more the escape. I was super excited to go. It was my first time. Spent some time in the shops, spent time exploring. I went record shopping, went to, what's the name of the Bowery area?
Kapabashi,
which is just like the Bowery times 200. It was really cool. Picked up a bunch of stuff for the restaurant and just for myself and gifts and things.
What kind of stuff did you pick up?
We got some small stuff. Like, we got specific ladles. I got, like, sushi presses for sushi batara, like a press sushi. Little gifts. I got these really cool bottle openers to give out as gifts. They're huge and have these red tassels. I forget what they're called, like Bad Rabbit or something. They're really cool. I don't know, just little things like that. And I got a knife, which is always, you know, I think pretty cool to go to Japan and get a knife.
Oh yeah. Was it who's the knife from? Was this some random guy or what? Or did seek out someone?
No, it was the one shop there that had people that were actively speaking English, and so I could talk to them more. I was actually surprised. If you're in New York and you have access to Corin, you have access to most of the knives that are available there. Mm-hmm. From what I had seen. You can get some cheaper there. I believe the brand is called Sugimoto, and it was made in that in the neighborhood Tsukiji. That's how you pronounce it.
Where Tsukiji.
Made in the neighborhood where's the famous fish market. Mm-hmm. in Tokyo. So I thought that was cool, but also it was just I learned that after I bought it. I just needed a specific knife, and this seemed to be the best one.
Nice. Well, we're going to have to take just a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about the beverage program with Bill, and hang on. We'll talk to you in just a minute.
This one's called Happy by Jerome LOL, and you are listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I have the team from Ivan Ramen here, and they were just telling us a little bit about their trip that they just took to Japan, a kind of research trip. And Mike, you were telling me that you had some pretty interesting dishes while you were there.
Yeah, I got to knock a lot of things off my to-try list. We had whale, chicken sashimi, raw horse, sea cucumber, pig uterus, tons of stuff, tons of awful.
Wow, that sounds like an Andrew Zimmern kind of show.
Well, it was really surprising the way it's handled there. I feel like it was just interesting for the texture mostly. Like the flavor of a lot of the food was very subtle, and things were marinated or
aged.
Or just processed in a way where they were, the flavors were very, very subtle. And it was more all about texture. Like, there's funkier tripe at a lot of restaurants in New York than any, way funkier than anything I ate while in Japan.
And were these kind of everyday foods, or was this definitely like, that is the weirdest thing on the menu, and I'm curious, so I'm going to try it?
Most of the places we ate at, I couldn't read the menu at all, but this was all on the menu. It was restaurants that were specific to these things.
Well, I took him to one place the night before we left. I went to this awful restaurant that just specializes in all of that stuff. But and then we also went to a standing bar that specializes in anything made from the pig or from the cow. So they, you know, and, you know, in Japan, a lot of times they break everything down. So you can go to yakitori place where they use every single part of the bird, and maybe it'll come out as a course, you know. You know, they break down the intestines in many different parts of the intestine, whereas, you know, in the States, that might be considered racy or weird or whatever. There, it's just, you know, it's well done. Everything is made in a way that it's really not stinky. It's the flavors are subtle and deep and delicious.
The only time I've ever seen breaking down the intestine in different parts was at a restaurant here called Takashi.
Yeah, that's and Takashi here is a phenomenon, but in Tokyo, it's just really common.
Wow, that blows my mind.
Yeah.
And then Bill, tell us about how you got involved. I know you from Brooklyn Star, which I love. Just a great kind of neighborhood Brooklyn restaurant that everyone loves with a really interesting wine list. Great. I was telling one of our bartenders at Anfora that you're going to be on, and she was really excited. She's like, I love that place. You can go at like 1 a.m. and get like something great pretty much any night of the week. Right. So open late, great food.
Right.
How did you get involved in ramen?
Really easily. I responded to an ad that Ivan had put out looking for a general manager. We at the Brooklyn Star are doing really well. Into our third year, so I really had an itch to start a new project, one that I wasn't financially involved in, one I could just really just get emotionally attached to. I've been reading about Ivan for about a year, and I saw the ad. I said, I'll never get this job, but let me just see what my resume looks like. Threw it there, and I think within like a 24-hour span, I got an email back, which was really awesome. And as far as the Brooklyn Star goes, you know, that late night program is something that we started, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. And so it's really nice to hear that your friend likes coming in late. I've never ever tackled this pantry before. Never worked Japanese. I didn't really know too much about ramen. Actually, had my first bowl of ramen the week that I met with Ivan. I was going through. My wife was actually in the hospital, about to give labor, and I was interviewing with Ivan at a corner coffee shop, which was really exciting. You know, the more and more I talked to him, the more I understood exactly what he was looking to do and where I was coming from, and it really seemed like a good fit, a good match. He, you know, obviously his shops in Tokyo are much smaller and don't really have too much front of house mm-hmm. service. Everyone kind of orders from a machine and gets a ticket and gives it to the ramen guys, and that's that. As far as here, we really wanted to provide a really good, slick, straight to the point service. Let the food do the talking, and the servers just be there to support and walk you through maybe some of this food you've never heard before, or the beverage list. Because most ramen places that I've been to in the city it's very straightforward list. You don't really have anything more than a couple wines or maybe a couple soft drinks. Nothing, mm-hmm. nothing too crazy.
And tell us about that beverage list. I always found that pairing soups with drinks could be, or broths in general with drinks can be kind of challenging. I always fall back to anything that has bubbles. Right. But you have some time to dive into that a little more deeply.
Right. Well, once again, like learning from Ivan of his flavor profiles and actually getting the opportunity to go up to his house in Dobbs Ferry and eat a lot of the food and kind of see where his palate was coming from and hear what he'd like to drink with the food, which is something that's more drier and more crisp, mm-hmm. A little bit medium acidity as opposed to something so high in acid, is something that we were looking for. You know, we're going to have a six draft line system at our shop here in the LES, and you know, we're going to do really good beers, and we're going to have some wines on tap, which is really exciting. And then obviously some hard ciders. I think cider is a big go-to with his food or any ramen. That, and therefore, also obviously your original sake really goes really great with this stuff. So
I'm really curious about this wine with not too much acidity thing. And I'd love for you guys to tell me a little bit more about it. But may I take a guess as to where this comes from? Because with some of the fattier broths, I really do like some really crisp kind of wines, because that fattiness really coats your mouth, and then the acidity just kind of cleans it off a little bit. But I know that you're kind of scaling it back on the fat and doing something that's a little bit more subtle. Well, and so is that the idea?
It's not that I'm scaling it back. It's just that I think that there are different kinds of ramen. I tend to like a cleaner flavor. I tend to like food that, you know, I'm a chef, so I like to send people home feeling good. I mean, you know, a lot of times when you eat junky food, you kind of cram it into your mouth. It tastes great while you're eating it, and then for the rest of the day, you're kind of burping, and you're feeling bloated, and, you know, you're not feeling that great. And you just say, well, you know, I ate barbecue or I ate ramen, so, you know, I guess that's just how it is. But, I mean, I try to think about my food in a way that makes people, you know, feel uplifted. You know, some of my best meals, you know, 5 hours later, I have a big sheet-eating grin on my face, and I realize, wow, I'm just still smiling about that lunch I had or that dinner I had. And that's my sort of my fantasy about how I want people I feed to feel. I want them to just, you know, for their whole mood to be uplifted because they had some great food. And so the food I make tends to be, you know, I tend to use, I think, less fat. I mean, ramen is not a low-fat food. It's never going to be healthy. If it is, it probably doesn't taste that great. I don't think it, you know, I don't believe in low-fat hamburger either. You know, I mean, it is lighter in profile than some of the other types. And so I think some of the beverages we're thinking about don't necessarily need to be, you know, so high in acid. We're also serving a pretty extensive menu that's not ramen. So there's, you know, there's going to be many opportunities to drink other kinds of things as well, and then maybe get another beverage when you get your ramen or something that would segue very well from some of the smaller plates we're going to do.
And then also the other thing when talking about drinking is something that I learned from Ivan is I think that when you eat at ramen in places in New York, especially the American culture, you tend to eat soup like it's soup and not like it's ramen. And something that I learned very quickly with him is ramen's supposed to be eaten loud. You're supposed to slurp. You're supposed to enjoy the food. You're supposed to, you know, get in it. And really, there's an art of slurping, something that I probably will never conquer. But it's definitely something that's very similar to drinking, like when you drink wine mm-hmm. and you kind of, you know, rim the glass and you kind of smell and you kind of slurp and you kind of gargle a little bit in your mouth and swish it around. Very similar.
You're aerating all those flavors and that aromas. It reminds me of that scene in Tampopo where they have all these Japanese women taking a Western etiquette class.
Right.
Do you remember that? And they're trying so hard to eat their soup or their spaghetti.
My wife yells at me all the time when we go out for pasta and she goes, "Don't slurp your pasta." But, yeah, you know, Bill's right. That's sort of one of our themes of this whole restaurant venture is to sort of encourage our customers to eat ramen while it's really hot. I mean, there's really – ramen really – it's, you know what? I always say this, but my favorite example is that if you're a real New Yorker – I'm a real New Yorker. If you're someone who hangs out in New York and eats brick oven pizza, you would never get a brick oven pizza and like push it aside, finish your salad, finish your drink, chat with your friends, and then 20 minutes later dig into your pizza. You know, as soon as it hits the table, you stop. You stop eating your salad, you stop talking to your friend, and you at least get that first piece on your plate and get it in your mouth. And I've burned the roof of my mouth probably 175 times in my life eating pizza, and I still haven't learned my lesson. Because you got to eat it when it's smoking hot. That's when it's good.
And in ramen has a shelf life, so
it's about a nanosecond. I mean, like when I make ramen, it's hilarious. I mean, when I started this whole thing, and you know, when I started making ramen, I didn't have anybody to talk to. I mean, now I'm friends with all these guys who open ramen, who have ramen shops, and we talk about it. But you know, back then, there's very few books about it, and I didn't have anybody to ask advice. I just sort of made it up. And I sort of have this thing where, you know, as soon as those noodles come out of the water, there's this clock that's pounding in my head, and it's counting down. And I'm like, you know, the noodles are already starting to overcook. And so, you know, I get it into the broth, and then I get the toppings on it, and I hand it off to the customer, and I'm watching them, and I'm like, you know, eat.
You're getting anxious.
I'm getting anxious. I'm watching them. I'm like, come on. I mean, I've been known. I once had a guy who get up, and he left the table to go on his talk on his cell phone, and I ran outside, and I said, you know, your ramen's ready. He goes, give me a second. I said, no. You ordered the ramen. Now it's overcooking on the table. Get your butt inside and eat, you know, eat the ramen.
Why do you guys think so? 5-10 years ago, New York ramen was only instant ramen, right? I mean, there were a couple of places.
And I've never had instant ramen. I have to tell you, I've eaten instant ramen maybe 4 times in my life.
Well, you're making instant ramen.
But now I'm making instant ramen,
which I'm excited for, and hopefully we'll get to try it a little later. But now you have roundups of the best ramen, by neighborhood. You know, people are caring a lot more about ramen. Why do you think this is, and what is very different about your ramen from the rest of what's going on?
In New York?
In New York, yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm the kind of broth that we're going to be doing has not really taken off in New York yet. It's a double soup. It's a chicken and a dashi that are blended. You know, I make my own noodles. So I think my noodles have different texture than a lot of places. In Tokyo, too. My noodles are pretty unique in Tokyo as well. You know, it is called Ivan Ramen. So a lot of people say, you know, they say, well, I've never had that before. I say, well, because I never really... I just thought of it, and it's at the end of the day, it's really just my food in the form of ramen. So it's you know, and all my experiences of eating ramen over the last 25 or 30 years.
Have you had some experiments that have gone terribly wrong?
Of course. I mean, when I first started making noodles, I must have made noodles, you know, I made, you know, 50 different batches, and you know, a lot of them were lousy. Ramen is really complex to get it balanced just right. You know, it's a real balance of soup and flavoring and fat and noodles, and to have really good ramen, all that stuff has to balance well.
And I think also in New York, people love comfort food, and not having much of a background in this food, it's the ultimate of comfort foods.
Wow. Sure. So what you guys probably hear in the background is that Ivan is...
All right, so this is what we're doing. There's a whole method to this. And I have to try to remember what the frick it is. But so you get... When you have instant ramen, this is sort of upscale instant ramen. So it's already in its little bowl, and we're going to dump some... of these dried things in first.
What are the dried...
I just dumped in a thing of dried pork, which I should have gotten stopped at customs because I'm not supposed to bring in dried pork, but you know what? I'm not sure I agree with it, and I got away with it. And then we're going to add hot water, and then we are going to go ahead and put this... I have a little fat packet that we're going to lay on top of it to... here, you hold that, and I'm going to pour some hot water in. I don't know if this is... I don't think that's enough.
I'm going to reload.
Okay. So we're going to pour this in. It might just make it.
Wow, this is my first Ivan ramen. It's the instant version.
You want to just dump just a tiny bit more? And then we'll dump in a little bit more in here. We'll let it sit for 5 minutes. And then we'll mix it up, and you'll have some... You can get a facsimile of what I serve. So when I did this thing... So I don't like... instant food. I'll just step up and say I'm not a big instant food guy, up to the line. Especially a little bit more. Especially when I a little bit more. Stop. That's perfect. So when I started Ivan Ramen, getting your own instant ramen was very rare. It was now it's become quite commonplace 7 years later, but when I started it was not common for a store to get its own ramen with your name on or your face on the package. And you had to really be be pretty popular, and usually took at least 3 years. So I got this offer a 1 year in, which I told my wife, by the way, when I opened Ivan Ramen, I said, I'm going to have my own instant ramen. And she said, you're an idiot. but you know, but I really wanted an instant ramen because it's, you know, it's a testament to success to have one of these things. They came, so I got the offer. I said I was interested, but I said, you can't finalize the product without me giving my okay. So they would come in with what they thought was good, and we would taste it together. And I would, and the first 4 or 5 times, I was like, this is really terrible. And I got them to put whole wheat noodles in it, and I got them to do it with no MSG. And after the 7th or 8th time, we got it pretty close, and it went out. And the first time they did it, I think we did 350,000 or 400,000 units, and it sold out in like a month. They have 6,000. It's with a specific chain. Yeah, it's only 7. It's like 7-Eleven, but this is Circle K Sunks in Japan. They have 6,200 outlets. So, and I'd walk into one of their outlets, and there would be like a life-size pop-up of me, like, you know, with my hand pointing, and there would be like this whole row of Ivan Ramens in my face, because my face is on the cover of this thing. So it's pretty...
That's incredible.
It's pretty surreal, really.
So do you think it's going to be harder to open up a restaurant in New York or Tokyo?
Well, I mean, I don't think opening a restaurant anywhere is easy. I think, you know, opening restaurants is hard, and food is very subjective, and there's a lot of real incredible challenges to it. I mean, you know, the great thing about opening a ramen shop in Tokyo was that I didn't really do it. I mean, it was such a, like, shot in the dark. Mm-hmm. It was sort of, my wife had a great job, and she was doing very well, and it was sort of a project. And I had saved some money, so I had enough money to open the shop. But I didn't know, you know. I kind of figured it was going to be really successful or it's going to be a total bomb. And so I had some time to open it. We weren't under a lot of pressure to, like, start making money right away. So it was really a very great, you know, sort of way to open a business. And I think that, you know, the good part of opening right now is that, you know, I have some good... build up behind this whole thing. But opening a restaurant in New York is just as horrible as everybody said.
Yeah, they don't make it easy.
It's just the build out.
Can you give us an approximate opening date?
Yeah, well, hopefully mid-July. I mean, okay. It's getting closer now. Now, finally, we've gotten over some of the big hurdles, and we seem to be building pretty smoothly now. And if we can get all this stuff, you know, the food is something that we've been working on because we've had time. So we've spent a lot of time hanging out and cooking and tasting wines and talking about our service philosophy. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to put it all together. And that part, I think we're sort of ready on, you know, once we get in there, we'll be able to sort of lay it all out. But, New York's challenging.
Well, I mean, I can't thank you guys enough for being on the show. I wish we could do that Jon Stewart Daily Show thing where they're like, you can watch more on the web later on tonight. But unfortunately, we've got to wrap things up here. Guys, Mike, Bill, Ivan, I thank you so much, first of all, for coming on the show. Thank you for adding something to New York and bringing your shop to New York. I'm just so excited for it.
There's actually we're going to have a sneak little preview of the menu. We're doing Ivan's actually conducting a chef's class over at the Brooklyn Kitchen on Saturday, the 22nd of June. It's going to be really small, intimate, 30-seat gathering, whereas you're going to taste some stuff that is actually going to be on the menu, which is not all ramen, which is going to be really fun. So you can get tickets at thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Brooklynkitchen.com.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to – and Mike, thank you so much. We'll be seeing you down at the shop soon.
Yep.
All right, well, I'm going to dig into this ramen. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.